This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. At 90, former President Jimmy Carter's cancer diagnosis seemed dire. At the end of the summer, he announced that the form of melanoma he had spread to his brain. And now, just a few months later, at the age of 91, Carter made a big announcement. Standing before his Sunday school class in Georgia this past week, he revealed that his most recent MRI brain scan revealed no detectable traces of cancer.
I've been treated for my cancer with a new medicine that was developed just in the last few years.
That new medicine? A cancer immunotherapy drug. Joining me now to discuss how doctors are working to train your immune system to fight cancer are my guests. Padmini Sharma, she's scientific director of the immunotherapy platform at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Tony Rebus is a professor of medicine and director of a tumor immunology program, University of California at Los Angeles in California. Anthony, welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Let's talk about what is cancer immunotherapy, Anthony? What is the drug that was used, and what do we mean by that?
The idea is to use the patient's own immune system to attack the cancer, which has been a centuries-old idea that has been tried in many ways, but the way it's working with this new class of drugs is by releasing brakes to the immune system, where the immune system is trying to attack the cancer. The cancer is hiding from it, and then we take away what allows the cancer to hide.
What exactly does the cancer use to hide?
Whenever the immune system cells infiltrate the tumor, the cancer makes a kind of a shield by a protein called PD-L1. And what we do is block that, and then the cancer cannot hide, and the immune system attacks the cancer.
Wait, is this something relatively new?
It is. The concept comes from around 15 years ago when Dr. Jim Allison, who's the colleague of Pam Sharma, developed this idea that maybe we were wrong for 100 years trying to turn on the immune system with vaccines and things like these when we're dealing with cancer. That what we needed to do was to release its brakes.
Mm-hmm. And so you basically are training the immune system to find the cancer?
Yes. The immune system is designed to fight bacteria and viruses, things that come from outside. Mm. But when it's trying to attack something from inside, then it has a series of checks and balances that doesn't allow the immune system to work against the cancer, and the cancer hides behind that. Now with this new class of agents, it cannot hide anymore, at least in the patients where this works.
So, Dr. Sharma, what we're saying is that we've taken the defense mechanism, the hiding mechanism, away from the cancer cells so that our own body can attack it normally.
Yes. So, I mean, just to expand a little bit more on this idea, you know, the immune system is very, very powerful. I mean, the immune system is what keeps you protected from viral and bacterial antigens, as Tony just mentioned. But the other important thing is that the immune system has many off switches, so that not only does the immune system get turned on, but my immune system, your immune system, everyone's immune system has these off switches. So it's not just in the cancer patients. Mm-hmm. The off switches are important because the off switches make sure that the immune system does not take off and create autoimmune diseases, for example. So the off switches are very important. But what Jim Allison's group showed, that if you block these off switches, you allow the immune system to go for longer periods of time, which is what is necessary to allow for tumor rejection in cancer patients. And so understanding the basic immunology and understanding about these off switches, the first was CTLA-4, and now the second is the PD-1, PD-L1. These off switches, when we block them, allow us then to have a powerful immune response against cancer in some patients.
A lot of people have been reporting that that President Carter was cured. He's not officially cured, is he?
It would take time for us to follow him and do repeat imaging studies to look and make sure that the cancer is not recurring. But cure is the word we would like to be able to use after we see repeated imaging studies that do not show the cancer coming back.
Why in the studies are only about 30% of the people having as good a result as the president did?
So some of that has to do with the fact that there are multiple different off switches. So the drug that President Carter received blocks one of those off switches, but there are many, many other off switches. And so these off switches, we need to understand which tumor types they're playing a role in and which patients they're playing a role in so that we can block the appropriate off switches and maybe need to block multiple off switches so that we allow the immune response to take off and do the job in more patients.
Could the fact be that he is living past where most of us live, and he's in his 90s, and therefore maybe has a great immune system to begin with, and that when you tweak it up, it gets even better?
So we've seen these types of responses in both younger and older patients. So, and then actually what you're saying is opposite to what most people say, because most people say as you get older, your immune system is not as good. And so, you know, they think that these kind of responses are more seen in younger patients. But actually, we've seen these types of responses in both younger and older patients. It seems that we can create an anti-tumor immune response in all different age groups.
Mm-hmm. Rebus, what kind of side effects, Anthony, are we going to see with this? Or are there no really side effects?
So as Pam was saying, these off switches are not there for us to treat cancer. They're there because the immune system, when unleashed, can attack normal organs. But this particular one seems to be very specific for the immune system cells that were trying to attack the cancer. And whenever we release it, the side effects are really low. It's not chemotherapy, so it does not make the hair fall. It does not give nausea or vomiting. It's not the regular cancer treatment. In some patients, it can unleash an immune response against normal organs, and it will induce these diseases where the immune system attacks normal tissues, which is called autoimmunity. But with this particular one, pembrolizumab, Keytruda, and a similar one that's called nivolumab or Opdivo, it's in around 1 in 10 patients would have that kind of side effect.
Wow. Dr. Sharma, do you think it's possible? We always ask this question. That this kind of treatment can treat all cancers at some point with this type of therapy, even though it's currently only FDA approved for three types?
So first of all, it's an amazing thing that we've reached, right? This is an amazing time in cancer therapy because we now have immunotherapies that are working in multiple tumor types. It's working in melanoma, kidney cancer, and lung cancer. So what I wanted to say was we never even thought that was possible, that you can take one type of drug and basically have it work across all these different tumor types. And so the important point is that you're blocking an inhibitory pathway or an off switch on T cells, which is the soldier of the immune system. And so these T cells are the same in my body, your body, and every cancer patient. So it's not about the tumor type per se, it's about the fact that the T cells have these particular off switches. And so we think that we can figure out how T cells function and what the off switches are so that we can use it across all the different tumor types. Now again, you may need to use combination strategies for some tumor types, whereas other tumor types you can use a single agent drug. But we think that we will come up with immunotherapy strategies to treat many, many different tumor types.
Once this drug does alert the T cells that, you know, to fight the cancer, are they good forever? I mean, do you have to keep giving the drug now that the immune system knows what it should be looking for?
Well, that's, again, it's the beautiful thing, because when you're treating the immune system, which is what these drugs are doing, you're allowing then for a memory response. If you think about it, when you get the polio vaccine or you get the smallpox vaccine or any kind of these vaccines that you get in your childhood, they allow you to have these type of memory responses, whereas later on in life, if you encounter the antigen, you have these memory responses that can eliminate the antigen before you actually develop the disease. And it's the same thing here. These drugs are treating the immune response, and so when you stop the drug, the immune response has still evolved to hopefully give you this memory response that can then treat the cancer if it ever does show up again and treat it before it becomes a real problem for the patient. So we think it's these type of memory responses that are allowing us to see these 10-year or more survival of patients. And so we're hopeful that that's what will allow us to use the word cure. This is very different from when we did chemotherapy or radiation therapy because those were targeting the tumor cells, not the immune response. Right. And so when you stop the drug, the response is gone. But here, when you stop the drug, the immune system still survives, and that is what gives you that memory.
And it could be still mopping up other cells that are floating around.
Absolutely.
Wow. Wow. Dr. Rebus, where would you go from here? Where's the next step on this?
this step has been really important to know that a series of cancers can be treated by these unleashing the immune system and attacking the tumor specifically. Obviously, the next step is to understand how it happens and why does it work in some patients and does not work in many others. And by studying that, then it allows us to think of what's missing in the patients where this is not working and how do we develop a combination therapy that could treat those other patients.
So you can't be really happy until you can figure out how to pull in the other two-thirds of the patients that didn't really respond as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. What this is doing, it's increasing my level of expectations of the treatment. I think that every patient should be able to get this benefit, and if we don't achieve it, it's because we have missed something. But it's been a long process of translating knowledge from basic immunology and basic biology into these treatments. It's a big accomplishment of advance of science and giving benefits to patients, including President Carter.
Dr. Sharma, you agree?
I absolutely agree. I think the next step for us now is to look at these large numbers of patients that we are able to give benefit to, understand how they were able to achieve the benefit, and then do the same thing or understand what are the mechanisms preventing that benefit from the other two-thirds of patients, as you mentioned, and make sure we can release the other breaks that may be coming into play or bringing in the other cells that are necessary, not just the T cells, to allow us to then have all of these patients having a clinical benefit. We want to make cancer something of the past.
Well, it's hard not to get excited about this, so we try not to. But it's amazing results. Thank you both for taking time to explain this all to us.
Thank you very much.
Padmini Sharma is scientific director of immunotherapy platform at MD Anderson Cancer Center, and that's in Houston. And Anthony Rebus is professor of medicine and director of the tumor immunology program at UCLA. That's in California. We're going to take a break, come back, and look at some crazy, wonderful photos from New Horizons close-up of Pluto. Amazing stuff after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. All summer and fall, we've been treated to spectacular photos from Pluto. And remember the first images that were beamed back by the New Horizons spacecraft? They just showed a tiny little dwarf planet, small pixelated brown dot. But boy, that was exciting. And then we got closer. We saw the whale tail and then the canyons and the mile-high ice mountains. Mile-high came into focus. And for you Pluto geeks, the photos released this week, they're going to knock you out. The high-resolution photos were taken at the closest point. That's about 7,000 miles away. And you can peer inside the craters. You can even see the ripples on the plains. And William McKinnon is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Also, the New Horizons Geology and Geophysics Deputy Lead. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, lovely to be here, Ira.
How exciting are these things? I get tired of asking that question. The next one's even more exciting.
Well, this is the apex. These are the highest resolution images, and they, you know, we cut across the entire disk of Pluto, and we see stuff we've seen before at lower resolution, but this is the very best. It's very exciting.
Okay, let's talk about the mile-high ice water mountains on Pluto. What details can you see from these high-resolution photos?
Well, let me just say one thing. They're not mile high, they're 3 miles high.
Oh, I'm cheating
anyway,
the matter of their growth.
So they're even more amazing.
Yeah.
So you can see all sorts of amazing details. You can see the layers on the sheer faces of the mountains. You can see how they're jammed together like logs at a dam. And they look like they've actually crushed smaller mountains and, you know, pieces of ice in between them. It speaks to some sort of really ancient cataclysm on Pluto.
Wow, a cataclysm of what? Ice pushing against itself?
Well, we aren't really sure. It probably has something to do with large impacts, but then also the evolution of the planet, because Pluto is still an active body today, which is, of course, is one of the great findings of the whole mission, that we can travel to the ends of the solar system where the sunlight is very feeble and the surface temperature is very low, and we still see stuff happening just like it's, you know, Earth or Mars.
Yeah, and of course, there's the question of why are there only mountains on one side of Pluto?
Ah, you are very perceptive. If I knew the answer to that, I'd write a paper right away. it must have something to do, we think, with the contours of the what we informally call the Sputnik Planum Basin, which we think was ultimately created by a huge collision billions of years ago. But it's probably deeper on one side and shallower on the other. And it basically must have let loose a lot of ice debris kind of on one side.
Hmm. And there's some sort of, one of the interesting photos here, that some sort of shoreline crashing into these mountains. And you can see like ripples.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. You know, all these mountains are jammed together, but then they stop.
Yeah.
And that's where this place Sputnik Planum starts. And basically it's a giant sheet of exotic ices, you know, because on Pluto, water ice is like rock on the Earth. And on Pluto, what takes the place then of water, vapor and liquid water and water ice is ices of nitrogen and carbon monoxide and methane. And it's this great sheet. But when you get these super high resolution images where you can see basically things that are smaller than the length of a football field,
right.
You actually see that the surface is kind of fluted and rippled. And we don't really know what's going on. Some people think it's wind, but of course Pluto has an atmosphere, but not very much wind now, but maybe it had a thicker atmosphere in the past. Another idea is that these ices are still volatile. You know, solid nitrogen is pretty easy to vaporize, even at Pluto's distance from the sun, and there may be a kind of sublimation pattern forming as the ice just sits there exposed.
Is there more ice being added all the time? I mean, you look at all this ice, as you say, 3 miles high. Where did all this water come from?
Ah, out there in the outer solar system, water and water ice is like the most important component of crusts and mantles of, you know, icy satellites and bodies like Pluto. But inside Sputnik Planum, we actually see flow of what we call the glacial ices, the solid nitrogen and so forth, moving down out of the mountains and flowing onto the plains in that big, big basin. And how this works is that basically sunlight evaporates nitrogen gas, which then condenses elsewhere on the planet, and it piles up in a not too different way that, you know, snow piles up on the Earth. And basically makes a glacier, and it goes downhill. There's a cycle, and as this happens, it creates some of these fantastic landscapes.
Yeah. And now some of the photos show, great photos showing plains dotted with craters, and we can actually see inside these craters so well that we can see that there are different colored layers in the craters.
Yeah. So you see dark layers, and then when you apply the color data we have, we can see that these layers are red, so there's probably some organic matter involved. And you can hop, literally, from crater to crater and see that you're looking at the same layering. So basically, we're looking at some sort of important substratum that is telling us about some event or compositional change in Pluto's history. What that is exactly, we'll have to work on. In the months and years ahead.
Well, a lot of times when we see colors on the planets, we think there's some sort of organic basis. Would that be true here, too, on Pluto?
Yes, because one of the common ices that's on the very surface is solid methane mixed in with the other stuff. And when you bombard it with radiation, which you get in outer space, it starts to make more complex organic molecules. And when you do this in the lab, it turns red. So that's what we think it is. You know, there's lots of red in the solar system. There's sulfur can be red, and iron oxide on Mars can be red. But we think the red in the outer solar system has to do with these organic materials.
Would that be true of the ion on Jupiter, the big storm?
That is one of the great mysteries of planetary science, is what makes the great red spot red. The leading hypotheses have to do actually more with sulfur compounds or even phosphorus compounds.
But
we don't know yet. We'll have to drop a probe in and find out.
You know, it's every time I talk to scientists, they don't want to know the answer because they want to keep the guessing going. They want to keep the trail hot, you know?
I want to know the answer.
Well, let's talk about some more questions. Let's talk about Pluto's Badlands. Can you describe the area called the Badlands?
Yeah, well, if you sort of fly over the sort of, you know, the frosty ice plains with the craters that we were talking about, all of a sudden you come to a great cliff. It's about a mile high. And this is actually part of a fault, a great fault system that has split part of Pluto apart. And then you'd basically end up in this very rugged, kind of dangerous looking area. We're not exactly sure what went on there, but it looks like it's been deeply eroded by various processes. So probably glacial, probably wind to some degree, and I wouldn't be surprised if in Pluto's distant past there was even flowing liquid, but this liquid would probably be something like liquid nitrogen.
So what I hear you saying is that Pluto is still sort of an active planet. Oh, excuse me, subplanet.
Well, you know, dwarf planets are planets too. It's part of a whole class of, you know, other bodies that everybody should know about. And they're just as active, okay?
Yeah.
That's the beauty of going all the way out there and seeing all this. I mean, it could have turned out, I suppose, otherwise, just craters, but that's not what's there.
Is there more data and photos coming in? Is the drugstore still sending stuff back?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I just got the call yesterday. No, what I mean is the more of these very, very high-resolution photos are coming in tomorrow, and that will actually complete that set. Plus, there's really all sorts of other data, color data, spectral data that tells us the composition and all sorts of other things. We really probably only have about 25% of the total data down on the ground so far. The rest of it, the 75%, is still up on the spacecraft, and it's going to take us almost another year to bring it all down.
Oh. Any other photos from the other moons coming back? Are we done with them?
I think we have the best stuff from the other moons, at least in terms of landscape, but we have all sorts of, you know, other more distant observations that help us understand the properties of the surface that people are looking forward to getting.
Well, the good news is we've got another whole year to look at more photos.
We've got a whole year of great stuff to look at. Plus, we're actually on target, if NASA approves, to explore an even further body in the Kuiper Belt, which we will get to New Year's Day in 3 years.
Which is?
Well, right now we call it 2014 MU69, but it's a small body in the Kuiper Belt, and it's part of our overall mission, not just to explore Pluto and its five moons, but to visit as many Kuiper Belt objects as feasible.
I hear the Star Trek music welling up in the background. To go where no probe has gone before.
Well, that's exactly what we're doing. It will, in fact, be the most distant body visited by the human race when we get there in 3 years.
I cannot top that with anything. Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
William McKinnon is professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He's also New Horizons Geology and Geophysics Deputy Leader. And you can see these photos of Pluto on our website. They are fantastic at sciencefriday.com/Pluto photos. If you're a science geek like me and you like books too, there's one end of year ritual that you can always look forward to on our program. And I don't mean spiking the eggnog. I mean making that end of the year book list. And now is the time to celebrate all the science books that made you think, made you laugh, interrupted other people's concentrations. Yeah, do you do this by blurting out, "You aren't going to believe this," and then you upset the person who's trying to do a crossword puzzle or something like that? It works for me all the time, or it doesn't work, especially for books like this. There was Ginger Strand's The Brothers Vonnegut, about Kurt Vonnegut's connection to weather research. Neal Stephenson's millennia-spanning sci-fi epic Seven Eves. I really like that one. Sherry Turkle's look at digital age communication in a reclaiming conversation. And I know everybody out there has their list, so why not share it? Give us a call with your top science read for 2015 at 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-8255. Or you can tweet us at SciFry, and maybe you can help out a fellow listener find that perfect gift. But we're going to get the conversation going, kick it off with two of our most omnivorous is good for devouring books, I think. Don't you think, Maria? Maria Popova is the editor and founder of brainpickings.org. She joins us here in our New York studios. Always good to have you back.
Always good to be back.
Deborah Blum is the director of the Night Science Journalism Program at MIT, the author of The Poisoner's Handbook. She joins us today from Cambridge. Great to have you back, Deborah.
It's great to be here.
Any more poisoning books this year on your list?
I'm writing a poisoning epic book. No one will ever come near me once I finish it, I'm afraid.
You do have that record, you know. let's start then, Deborah, with your criteria. What science book got to make your book end list this year?
You know, I thought this was a wonderful year for books about science, but the book I'm going to talk about first is not a, what you might think of as a classic science book. It's H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, which is just an amazing book, you know, beautiful and chilling and haunting to read. It's actually it's the story of a daughter grieving the loss of her father and in a very depressive sense, but she copes by becoming a falconer, and she trains a hugely wild, very dangerous kind of hawk called a goshawk. And the book uses both that relationship, right, to explore natural history, this amazing bird, the way we relate to the natural world around us. I love the book. It's about how we cope with death and how we cope with life, and it does that so beautifully because life itself needs coping with, but it makes you see this in this amazing picture of the natural world. It's just an incredible, mesmerizing book.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Deborah Blum and Maria Popova about this year's best books list. Let me ask you, Maria, for your first pick, and then I want to ask about what makes a good science book, why it fits into your criteria as a great science book.
So I'll answer that first because it actually frames why my first pick is my first pick. There's a lovely 1969 interview with E.B. White in which he says that one must write up to children and not down, and anybody who writes down to them is wasting their time. And I think what's true of great children's books is true of great science books. They ought to do three things, I think, for the reader, which is to explain, to enchant, and to elevate. They need to tell you what something is and why it matters, get you captivated to care enough about it, and then to take pleasure in understanding it, and then leave you in a higher state of understanding whatever aspect of the world the book tried to explain. So my first pick is On the Move by the late, great, sorely missed friend of sci-fi, friend of brain pickings, friend of the world, Oliver Sacks. To me, Oliver Sacks was a Copernicus of the mind and a Dante of medicine who turned the case study into a poetic form. And he did that because his life and work were one. They sprang from the same source. So his autobiography is so much more than this limited genre term implies. And to me, it's really a dialogue with time on the scales of the personal, the cultural, and the civilizational. We see him going from world champion weightlifter to world-renowned neurologist. We see him as a young gay man in the 1960s trying to find true love, very different from our marriage equality world. And then we see him on the beaches of City Island, where he lived for a long time, watching the horseshoe crabs mate just like they did 400 million years ago on the shores of Earth's primordial seas. And he talks about all of that beautifully and enchantingly, but also very much as a scientist.
Yeah, and he exposes parts of himself about who he was that we never had any idea about. And it is a great book. We have to go to the break, and I don't want to start another conversation, but he is somebody we sorely miss, certainly at this time of the year when we think about gift-giving and books.
He was a giant.
Deborah, do you feel the same way about Oliver?
Yes, I do. I think that he inspired a whole generation of both science writers and lovers of science to see the world in a different way and to see it in a more intricately knit, fascinating, connected way. And that's actually one of my criteria for a great science book, is that you finish it. And it reminds me of what you said earlier, Ira, you know, when you interrupt someone because did you know this? But it changes. I do that all the time. But it changes
so
the
bad.
Way you We would be terrible playing games together, right? But it changes the way you see the world. You think a little differently. And a good science book does that in a way that makes you feel welcome into that conversation. Let's talk about this together.
All right. We're going to continue that conversation with Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Maria Popova, editor and founder of BrainPickings.org, And we want to hear from you. Give us some suggestions. 844-724-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's our annual end of the year book party, so to speak. One of the great books of 2015 with Deborah Blum and Maria Popova. Our number, 844-724-8255. We're having some suggestions coming in even as we speak. So let's go to them right now. Let's go to Rob in Portage, Michigan. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Hey there. Go ahead.
I read a book early this year called The Martian, which then they made into a fabulous movie.
It's a book
about engineering and about science, about solving problems.
You mean The Martian?
Yes.
Yeah. It was a great book, but you know, we have to disqualify because it came out last year. It feels like this year.
Yes, it's when the paperback.
And the movie and all that kind of stuff made it. But we'll allow you to suggest it as a great read because I love the book. I love that we had the author on. It was great. Deborah, pick number two. Give us your second pick.
Well, my second pick is obviously I'm going to sound like I'm doing a theme of strange creatures here, but my second pick is a book called The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery. And it's kind of a really surprising book, but what it does is it looks at consciousness. So it takes this little known deep sea species that we all tend to think of, I don't know if we all do, but many people imagine in a kind of Jules Verne monster sense. Mm-hmm. And it makes it into, not even makes it, it allows you to see the octopus as a creature with relationships and reactions, affection, social awareness of itself and others. There is this one octopus in the story that for some reason hates one of the people in the aquarium where it lives. And literally years later, when this man comes back, it squirts him across the room, right? Just looks, can see his face and say, oh, yeah, that's that person I really hate, right? And so it allows you to realize how complex they are. And in the course of doing it, and it's just beautifully written, it asks, what's self-awareness and what's recognition of others and how do we define that? And it moves you away from that idea that those kind of reactions are strictly human. So in that sense, it kind of opens up the natural world.
It's an octopus with an attitude.
Yes,
Jules Verne was right in 20,000 Leagues.
If that had been a boat, it would have been in trouble.
Yeah, you know, and we have special fondness for octopuses and all kinds of cephalopods on Science Friday. We have cephalopods.
As the Oliver Sacks.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I could get into a story about him coming on one week. Many, many years ago when he came on, we told him we couldn't interview him for the whole hour because we had a guy searching for giant squid out in the South Pacific. And he said, can I stay on? This is my favorite subject, he said. We didn't believe him. And then, so we were talking to him early in the week, and on Friday, he shows up in the studio with a cephalopod T-shirt, and he's got two giant squids, one in each hand, squeezing on the rubber little squid, saying, "I'm ready for this show." And it was great, and he was more eager to get done with his interview so he could hear us talking to the guy who was looking in by satellite phone for the giant squid. Okay, Maria, what's your next pick?
It's about another extraordinary scientist. It's called Alexander von Humboldt and the Invention of Nature by design historian Andrew Wolf, whom you had on the show a couple months ago. And it's a kind of cultural resurrection project that links much of our contemporary understanding of life to this remarkable man who was once the most famous scientist of his time and a huge influence on Darwin and Mariah Mitchell and Goethe and Thoreau, and who's now pretty much forgotten. But he pioneered the idea that life isn't this hodgepodge of disjointed elements and phenomena, but an intricate web of connectedness, of interconnectedness, where everything is in constant dynamic interaction with everything else. To Deborah's point earlier, this is very much the kind of book that makes you appreciate that and appreciate how this forgotten hero really paved the way for the modern environmental movement. And in sort of dusting him off and relating him to today, Andrew Wolfe is performing, I think, a tremendous act of public service.
Yeah, because no one in America, you ask anybody that they've ever heard of him, probably
mm-hmm.
never.
Well, Chicago's yeah. Humboldt Park is probably yeah. as close
well,
as
we all know. We all know a Humboldt something.
Yeah,
but we didn't know where it came from, mm-hmm. or who you know who it was named after. And it was. I agree with you. It's one of my. Great
and he
books
also
of the year.
He popularized science by seeing culture in the same integrated way. So he related science to art and philosophy and poetry and history in a way that was pretty much unprecedented before. So even our science communication can be traced back to Humboldt.
Yeah, he's sort of a Richard Feynman in that sense. That,
well, Richard Feynman. Is a Humboldt in that sense.
Okay. Well, go on. I'll take that. Let's see if we can go to the phones, get another suggestion or two. Let's go to Barbara in Maryland. Hi, Barbara.
Do I turn the phone off now?
Yes.
I mean the radio off now?
Turn the radio off. There's an old song.
Okay,
turn
it's
it
off
on.
Now.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. This isn't the same kind of science, but it's really interesting. It's called Ghost Boy. A boy goes home from school, he's 12 years old, has some kind of virus that leaves his body rigid, and he can't speak, he can't do anything. And he's been abused by different caretakers and all that. But his parents, you know, take care of him. So 12 years later, I believe, they have this new invention where you can use your eyes to use an alphabet board. And he passed the test because that's one thing that still moved. And they found out that this boy was brilliant inside of him just because of this invention. And he went on to be able to use a computer and fix computers that other people had problems with, and just really a brilliant one. But just because of this one invention, it opened the whole world to this boy that his body was rigid and he couldn't speak. So I think it comes under science, so I don't know what you feel.
Well, it's sort of a mini Stephen Hawking story, you know, mm-hmm. where Stephen Hawking was able to continue his career because they kept inventing new machines that he could use. It's called Ghost Boy. Have you ever heard of Maria?
No.
No? Deborah? No.
No, I don't know. But I think, you know, one of the things that's so interesting is that it reminds us of all these ways that the new technologies that we're coming up with now are like saviors for some people, yeah. right? They yeah. enable all kinds of interesting ways of allowing you to communicate or move the body or connect in different ways. It's a whole fascinating new field.
Mm-hmm. Maria, your next pick.
I have Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs by Harvard cosmologist and particle physicist Lisa Randall, whom you've also had on the show earlier this year. On the surface, well, really on the cover, the book is about this really original theory that links dark matter to the extinction of the dinosaurs by proposing that 66 million years ago, a minor perturbation in the outermost solar system caused by dark matter dislodged a comet out of orbit and hurled it toward Earth and ended up... as the meteoroid that killed the dinosaurs and three quarters of living creatures. But the theory, I think, is just a clever guise to tell this larger story of how the universe evolved and mm-hmm. even what made our own existence possible, because lest we forget, had the dinosaurs not perished, large mammals wouldn't have come to dominate Earth and we wouldn't be here to make sense of the origin of the universe. And in a way, this book is the cultural progeny of Humboldt, because it's very much concerned with exposing how these seemingly unrelated events across space and time are actually profoundly related to everything we experience as life, weaving together physics, biology, yeah. geology, ecology, and even the social sciences. And I have to say, this is one of those books that very much talks up to you, that takes you for an intelligent peer and, to borrow Oliver Sacks' wonderful term, for a thinking animal, which I think is just a lovely compliment to the reader.
You know, what also struck me when Dr. Randall was on the program is I mentioned to her that it's also a journey of a scientist outside of her own field,
Yeah, she had to learn about these other disciplines.
And
yeah.
she and her delight in discovering there were other things out there that she could enjoy as much as what she was doing, you know, what she does about her physics.
Well, yeah, but that's also an undercurrent of the book itself. The sheer amount of humanity and serendipity and messiness that goes along with all the rigor of how science is done. From the two scientists who discovered cosmic microwave background radiation by cleaning pigeon poop off their telescopes to the crazy 30-year detective story to prove that it was indeed a meteoroid that killed the dinosaurs, and then following a global scavenger hunt to find its location. There's all of this kind of excitement and thrill and human, just, you know, humanity around the science.
Yeah, you know, Deborah, I love books which, you know, start out with a single topic, but then they branch out so widely that you get to learn so much more about other things that, you know, that are meaningful, but, you know, they just take sidetracks and they're wonderful to learn about also.
I do, too. And one of the books on my list is Rain by Cynthia Barnett, which just takes the topic of rain and makes it an exploration of the entire universe. It, you know, actually has this lovely beginning, and when she looks at Ray Bradbury imagining this blue rain on Mars, speaking of the Martians, and then goes back to how do we decipher the first rains and drought, and is there rain in outer space, and it's sort of a poetic cultural exploration of everything through the lens of rain.
Mm-hmm. And Plucked. Familiar with that book?
Yes, yeah. I love Plucked. Yeah. I'm so excited to be talking about it, which I know is going to make me sound weird, but it's
too late for that.
I'm not way
I
too
sense
late.
Another weird creature.
I just love it. No, Plucked is not chickens, actually. But it's a history of hair removal, and it's written by an academic, Rebecca Herzig. And it's such a fascinating book because it takes, again, this one subject, our obsession with hair on the human body, and starts when we first started seeing it as a kind of class issue, you know. Mm-hmm. The higher classes have less hair, and then it runs through all the different sort of technologies and chemistries of removing hair, and it has this amazing chapter. This is where I would have interrupted your game, Ira, in which it's called, I think, Soft White Velvety Skin, and it's looking at young, affluent white women in the early 20th century who would go to X-ray salons because they would go to be irradiated so that their skin almost all over their body would be hair-free. And I'm reading this, and it was really one of those first, I had no idea kind of moments,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it's also a reminder, and I think it's important to remember this too, that we get so gee-whizzy about these new technologies without fully understanding them, and so we repeat this pattern of putting ourselves at risk, which is one of the things I like about history of science,
yeah,
in the same way that Maria references dusting off important and influential sciences. I think when we go back, we get to dust off important and influential mistakes.
I got to dust off a break here. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about our favorite books of the year with Deborah Blum and Maria Popova. Let's go to the phones. I think we have some interesting, let's see who we go. Oh, yeah. Let's go to Bill in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Bill.
Hello, sir.
Yes. Welcome.
Hey. Basically I think it was The Material Explainer by Randall Monroe.
The Thing Explainer. Love that book.
Yeah, I've already got What If memorized, the first one.
I've already given two away as gifts to kids because it's that's a great. What did you like most about it, Bill?
I know it sounds funny, but the clarity of it in the, because I am finding myself teaching GED to folks, English as a second language, as well as folks that didn't graduate high school, and it's perfect.
Mm.
It's like, makes all the fancy terms so much less scary.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
And gives science to folks that are scared of it.
Yeah. Thanks for that suggestion. It is a good book. Marie, are you familiar with that book?
I am. I very much love Randall Munroe's work, and last year's book, What If, is wonderful. I mean, as far as blog-turned-book adaptations go, which generally are not great, this is fantastic.
Yeah. And Deborah, you had something?
Yes. I love Thing Explainer because as a writer, you start really thinking about, well, how do I tell these stories of science, right? He does such an amazing job of taking 1,000 common words and applying them to all sorts of complicated ideas. It is really fun.
What I also loved about the book, being a geek and like to know how things work, I like the size of the book. I like the fact that it loses a lot on a Kindle. If you read this book, it's an oversized, big book. It feels great to go through the pictures. There are pictures that fold out from the center of it. It's the kind of book made the way it used to make books, you know? And
yes.
You can't read this on a Kindle, really. There,
agreed.
I said it.
Although, what if I've got a minute, one of my other books is a very little book.
Please.
Which is
I've got a minute. That's about it. Go ahead.
The Hunt for Vulcan by Tom Levinson. And I mean, it's almost a stocking stuffer size book, but it's a beautiful little book proving that I'm interested in other things besides strange animals. It's about a planet that we once thought existed called Vulcan. And scientists in the 19th century were so convinced that it existed that they actually reported sightings of it, even through telescopes. But it never existed. And it was disproved by Albert Einstein when he began to explain his theory of general relativity. So it's a wonderful look at this mythical planet and also how science works, I think.
Yeah, I like Tom Levinson. I think we missed that book. Let's see if we get The Hunt for Vulcan. Any last word? You got 15 seconds, Maria.
I have... let's go with this one. I have The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage by Sidney Padua, who had also on the show. And it's the story of how these two eccentric Victorian geniuses, Ada Lovelace, the first computer programmer, and lovable curmudgeon Charles Babbage, invented the first computer, the analytical engine. But what's really wonderful about the book is that although it's a comic book, it's really a masterwork of scholarship and footnotes.
All right, there you have it. Deborah Blum and Maria Popova, thank you both for joining us, picking out those books. And you can see all of their selections on our website at sciencefriday.com/books2015. And while you're there, you can leave your own recommendations in the comments sections. And while you're on our website, you can find a story you have to see to believe. This is stunning illustrations of colorful fish species in the Salish Sea. They're incredibly lifelike. I swear they look like they're swimming off the screen. And they're not photos. They're drawings. It's unbelievable. You got to check them out. sciencefriday.com/fish drawings. Have a great holiday weekend leading up to a big holidays coming up. Have a safe weekend while you're out there shopping. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.